Mark Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be across this great world of ours, the planet, all 24 time zones covered by this program. It is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Art Bell. And I would like to welcome a new affiliate tonight, WRGA in Rome, Georgia. 5,000 watts in Rome, Georgia on 1470, a good regional station there. The GM, Greg, I hope I get it right, Commishlian, I believe it is, Greg Commishlian, and the PD, Randy Quick. Welcome. Glad to have you on board. What is a different kind of radio program? And tonight, indeed, different again. I don't know, maybe you've got to be the right age. Not really, though. Not in this day of oldies stations. But I'm the right age. And Eric Burden and the Animals. I'll tell him when he was here. Eric Burden is going to be on tonight. Should be kind of interesting. A lot of stories about Jimi Hendrix and Eric Burden, the Animals. Now, I was in the Air Force, and I was stationed for the most part of my time in the Air Force in the Far East. Except with the exception of that, here in the U.S., it was all in the Far East. Okinawa, the Philippines, Vietnam. And there were some songs that were almost like national anthems to people in the service. Like, getting out of this place, we gotta get out of this place. Oh man, that was a national anthem. House of the Rising Sun. It was like a national anthem if you're in the service. Doesn't matter where you are, wherever you are normally in the service. You just hate it on principle, you know. I don't care whether it's the Hawaiian Islands, wherever you are, you know, it's the rock, it's where you are, it's where you have to be, and so you don't like it. Sorta. Later memories revise that, but at the time, those songs, I can't even tell you how important they were. All right, now the scariest part of the show, the news. You know, I figured out, of all the things that I do, reading the actual news at the beginning of the program is probably the scariest stuff you'll hear. Our president, President Bush, sought to dispel China's doubts of distrust of America, urging the communist Chinese on Friday to embrace liberty, tolerance, and religious freedom. Dissent is not revolution, said Bush. I'm sorry, I just, you know, I know the communist Chinese. And I can assure you, whatever they're going to embrace, the last ones are going to be liberty, tolerance, and religious freedom. It just is not going to happen. Not with that regime, not with the regime that's there now. And I shouldn't be laughing about this, but there's absolutely zero chance, and those would be the last on their list to embrace. You know, that's a serious police state over there. Pakistani authorities said today a videotape showing Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl being killed by the Islamic extremists who kidnapped him a month ago has arrived, and they do believe he is indeed dead. The president making a comment, and Musharraf is acting swiftly, he says, to apprehend each and one of the gang of terrorists involved in the killing. The southern Philippine waters had some trouble for us today, as in the U.S. and Philippine military forces. A U.S. Army helicopter carrying 10 Americans crashed into the sea, MH-47 Chinook, which was ferrying troops in a counterterrorism exercise. We're kind of moving into the Philippines now in the war on terror. There was no mechanical trouble reported, nor was there any rebel activity that might have affected the flight. So there were no survivors, as far as I know, and they have no idea why it went down. Yasser Arafat is scrambling to see some arrested and try and probably move some of the tanks out from his front door. But they're still hitting his West Bank office. And the situation in Israel is deteriorating quickly. Military jets flew hundreds of sorties against a major rebel stronghold today, bringing Colombia's 38-year civil war to a potentially bloodier phase. So things are going wrong down in Colombia. And then in Toms River, New Jersey, a retired police officer, for absolutely unknown reasons, shot and killed his 22-year-old granddaughter today. Then promptly went door to door and killed three neighbors. Police said John Mabel, 70, retired from Newark Police in 76, was charged with four counts of murder. Bail set at $3 million. He was arrested as he sat on the front lawn of his home. On his steps, the .38 revolver. So he killed his granddaughter and then went house to house, killing as many as he could kill. Now you see what I mean. Oh, and a little bit of information that might not be out there otherwise, from Georgia. This is from Billy in Georgia. And he says, the total now in Georgia at the crematorium that didn't do its job is 290 bodies found. They found that a lake on the property, in fact, does contain more bodies, according to Billy, and are planning to drain it. Investigation is costing Georgia residents about $1 million every single day. He says so far, now this is pretty interesting. You remember I said I just didn't buy the whole motive of why this guy would have just disposed of bodies instead of cremation? So far, bodies dating back 18 years have been positively identified. A judge, according to Billy, has issued a gag order after the above information was released. So this may be the last we hear for a while. Billy lives about 30 miles from the scene. Now, I didn't buy the machine didn't work story when I heard it. I don't buy it now, and I certainly don't buy it over a period of 18 years. There is something else, something very serious going on there. There's another piece of news you might not have heard. This comes from the Times Knight Ritter Tribune News Watch, Business News Watch, in fact. An Alexandria woman said that she saw a flare or rocket ascending toward a U.S. Airways flight landing at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport last month, similar to a report from a Southwest Airlines pilot landing at Baltimore Washington International Airport on Sunday. The Federal Aviation Administration is investigating a report of by the pilot of Southwest Flight 454 that he saw what looked like a model rocket pass on the left side of his aircraft on Sunday evening. FAA says it has no reports of the rocket sighting by the Alexandria resident. And she said it was kind of like a rocket, a reddish thing that came up from the riverbank. She said it was aimed toward the back of the jet. Maybe the pilot didn't see it. She said she doubted that it was a model rocket. Didn't look like any model rocket I've ever seen. She said her son used to play with them, knows what they look like. It was right toward the back of the jet, right behind the engine, and went in at an angle like it was aimed at the jet. She added, however, the object didn't get close enough behind that it could have brought down the airplane, but, you know, obviously the implication here is, if true, that somebody fired something at a commercial airliner, and one other airliner pilot saw something zoom by his window as well, so you have to wonder what might be going on out there. I've got a story here entitled Antimatter Atoms Captured for the First Time, coming up in just one moment.
Now we take you back to the night of February 21st, 2002. On Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
So is kind of interesting. This is a Michio Kaku kind of topic, and we'll sure ask him about it. Antimatter's atoms, among the most elusive matter in the universe, have been captured for the first time. According to the standard model of particle physics, every particle has a corresponding antiparticle with the same mass and opposite charge. The pair annihilate each other on contact, releasing a burst of energy. Scientists have wondered if they might be able to harness this energy, but they found it difficult to make and control anti-atoms. Late 1990s, up to 9 anti-hydrogen atoms were detected in particle accelerators at CERN and at Fermilab near Chicago, but they were moving at almost the speed of light, much too fast to be stored or even studied. Now researchers on the ATRAP, A-T-R-A-P experiment at CERN, the European Lab for Particle Physics near Geneva, think they have made and stored thousands of anti-atoms indefinitely in a particle trap. This is really something. The team led by Gerald Cabressel of Harvard University used powerful magnetic fields to trap antiprotons found in the debris of collisions in CERN's particle accelerator. Then they introduced a beam of anti-electrons or positrons and used an electric field to slow them down and bring the two types of particles together. When the group exposed the particle trap to an electric field, some particles failed to move, suggesting that the charged antiparticles had bound together into neutral anti-hydrogen atoms. I wonder what this is going to mean for mankind. You hear of this kind of story. The atom bomb was bad. The hydrogen bomb was worse. And if they have actually succeeded in trapping and holding antimatter, then I've been told, or at least I believe it would be true, that an antimatter weapon, and they're not going to start by making antimatter cancer cures. Somebody's going to want an antimatter weapon, and if this is the first little foot in the atomic door, or should I say antimatter door, everything's atomic in some sense, but in the antimatter door, then mankind may have a big surprise coming down the road. And we handled, so far, element 92 without self-destructing. I wonder how we're going to do with antimatter. And you may recall the movies about the construction of the atom bomb and the scientists who were, irradiated and died horrible deaths in the Manhattan Project. And I wonder what happens if you make a similar mistake, but this time with antimatter instead of something coming to a rapid critical mass in your face. Matter and antimatter. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey, Art.
Hey there.
I've got an idea. What might have happened at this crematorium down in Georgia?
Over a period of 18 years?
Yeah. If it is the first actual vampire? Vampires keep a helper usually on Earth? This is the first time we've ever actually found a vampire's lackey, and those people weren't actually dead when they were put there.
Well, at this point, with a gag order, no more information coming out, I suppose you could speculate about anything you wanted, but that wouldn't be my first. But I don't have a first thing to jump to. I don't have a clue, and I don't buy the machine thing at all.
They've only identified 5 bodies.
Yeah. I don't buy the machine thing at all. I mean, 18 years, come on.
Yeah.
There's something really serious, something else here at work, and
sinister.
I really wish we could know, but now there's a gag order, apparently, and so maybe we won't. I appreciate the call, sir.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I probably wouldn't leap to the vampire thing, but The reason given so far is not what I feel is the ultimate reason at all. So I don't think we know it all yet. On the first-time caller line, you are on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art. How's it going?
Going okay, sir.
Hey, this is Joseph here in Atlanta.
Okay.
I am calling. I've been trying to get some information to you, or at least get in contact with you, about a supposed guest or a suggested guest for your show.
All ears.
Robert K. Brown.
And who is Robert K. Brown?
He is a retired military general who is also the head publisher and editor of Soldier of Fortune magazine.
Oh, no kidding. He probably would make a very interesting guest.
He has been in and out of Afghanistan over, I think, about an 18-year period. And his contributing editors have fought with the Taliban and fought against the Taliban.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and his contributing editors and himself have been into Colombia, Angola, South Africa, all over the world.
All the world's hot spots, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he would be the la creme de la creme of a good interview.
We'll look into it, sir. Thank you very much. Yeah, I bet there would be a lot of stories that could be told. Stories that, it's really amazing to me how many stories just never make it to the news. You never hear them. You know, unless you're listening to long-form talk radio like this, you're never going to hear them. This may be the only... Sometimes a story will break here and then, of course, spread to the mainstream press. That has happened many times. But other times, you will only hear it here. It will never go anywhere else. Doesn't mean it's not true. It just means that for some collective, interesting reason, the mainstream press doesn't print it. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
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 This is Jeremy.
Okay, Jeremy, turn your radio off. That's the first lesson.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, where are you, Jeremy?
I'm in Washington.
State or D.C.?
State.
All right. What's up?
There was a caller on the other show, the other day.
Yes.
And, they said, something about pop bottles frozen or something like that.
No. That was an email I read. The tree branches cracked and, you know, he ducked. He thought he was about to get hit in the head. And this frozen pop bottle plops down on the ground along with the broken branches. He took photographs, called the police, sent photographs to us, and I've got them on the website. Yes, what about
it? Well, another guy called says that there's no 3-liter pop bottles.
Somebody said that, yes.
Yeah, well, I just, maybe a month ago, I went to a store called Rite Aid, and they
had 3 liters?
Yeah, they have 3 liters. There's, I think, they were made by the brand of Rite Aid, I guess.
All right. Some other people told me that, too. It's still a very interesting story, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for calling. Have a good morning.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
Learn from us. of your gate and maybe tell you about Phaedra and how she gave me life and how she made.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
Little Coast to Coast AM factoid. There have been 9 M-class solar flares in the past 48 hours. Last 48 hours. Likely geomagnetic storms directly ahead. The sun really, really is acting up.
Now we take you back to the night of February 21st, 2002, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
This is interesting. Chuck in Toledo said, "Hey Art, we gotta get out of this place," was a Vietnam song. Sorry, not any other place. Chuck, you're crazy as a loon. That's what I would tell you. It was played not just in Nam, but all over the world. Just every military base that exists anywhere, anytime, ever played that song. So I don't know where you got the idea that was Nam song only. Not true. Trust me. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
This is Chris from Minnesota. I've been trying to reach you since you had your show about controlling the weather.
Oh, yes.
We've had just the strangest weather here. I live little over an hour from the Twin Cities South, and our tulips and daffodils are already starting to come up.
I know, Chris. There's another story on NOAA about the last 3 months being the last, the warmest recorded in history. Now, I've been getting this again and again and again and again. The story comes up about every 3 months. Now, that's beginning to tell us something.
Well, what's really weird is, not even a week ago, it was about 50 degrees. Then 2 days ago, we had thunder showers move. Now, Tuesday, our forecasted weather is a high of 8 degrees above zero and a low of minus 2.
I know. This is February, so it's wrong. I don't know what else to tell you, Chris. The weather is changing, and it's wrong. Now, whether it's by man's intended hand, unintended hand, by some natural method, I don't know, but I don't think there's any argument left. The weather is changing beneath our feet quickly, or actually above our heads, more likely.
Well, it sure seems to be.
Yep. Yep, no question about it. Thank you, Chris. Throughout the country, you would get similar stories in flowers. I'll tell you, here, our days are now suddenly, all of a sudden, out of nowhere. We were in a deep freeze for a little while, and now all of a sudden, here it is in February, and the apple blossoms are shooting out, and everything living in the desert has concluded that it's time to start doing its spring thing, so it has begun. And that's the situation pretty much across the country. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, it's Mike. I heard you talk about a couple nights ago about the Pope performing exorcisms.
Oh, yes, that story, that interesting story.
Right, and then last night, the gentleman from, New Zealand?
Australia, actually.
Australia, okay. And
close.
He talked about being possessed.
That's right.
Okay. I'm a born-again Christian, and you get rid of those demons in the name of Jesus Christ. And I've been performing exorcisms.
Yeah, but some do.
Right.
The problem with this is, how does a Buddhist get rid of a demon?
Well, all I know, I can just tell you from what I've lived.
Right. So I think that a Buddhist, what I'm getting at here is that I understand that you do it in the name of Jesus Christ,
right.
But a Buddhist might do it in the name of Buddha and also be successful in ridding the demon. So I'm not exactly sure what that says.
Well, I understand. I'm not calling in to judge anybody.
No. I understand.
But what I primarily called in for, Art, was I have part of an exorcism on tape.
You do?
Yeah, it's about 2 minutes. It's done with a not professional equipment, but you can hear the demon, and the woman gets free in the name of Jesus, and I can play it for you over the telephone if you'd like to hear it.
Play it.
It runs 2 minutes and 17 seconds.
This is not a commercial tape, is it?
No. It's exorcism that I did.
You did?
Yes, that play. I did on the
Well, all right. Is it understandable?
Yes, it is.
Play it.
Cross face, what? Yes, you're the strongest. You're the strongest? Is that all up in?
Yeah.
You're the gatekeeper?
Yeah. Yeah!
Father, in the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to come to attention. I lift this answer that this devil Bob gave me. I lift it up to you. If he lied to me, I pray the fire of heaven on him burning his right eye. Damn! And I want to hear it, God.
I got it. We all got it. Holy
okay.
Mackerel.
Well,
how long ago did that happen?
Oh, that was probably a couple of years ago. God led me doing this, started me doing this 19 years ago, Art. Over almost 20 years, to tell you the truth. And
that's dangerous work.
Well, it's put it this way, Art. The woman was glad that I was there and God was there to get her free.
I'm sure she was.
It's not about the devil, it's about God, okay?
I got you, sir.
But anyway, I just thought you might be interested in it. I'm sorry the tape wasn't a better quality.
No, it
was. It's homespun, you know.
It's all right. I got it. We all got it. Believe me. Thank
okay.
you. Take care.
All right.
All right. I'm a firm believer in, you know, good and evil, the real forces of good and evil. I don't know if you call them God and the devil and Lucifer, or Buddha, or what you call them. These are all names, and there were mostly all early prophets from these deities, entities, or a single creator. Who knows? Just imparted in different ways. You know, when you study the various religions, they all basically say pretty much the same thing. Now, a lot of people, of course, mispractice all of them. And you end up with plenty of people killing plenty of people in all of their names. But that doesn't make them any less real, or that singular entity any less real. So when you hear something like that, it's... First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art. How are you?
I'm okay.
Good. Say, Art, I had a question about that fellow that called a couple of nights ago. He was somebody, I believe he was in the military, said that he was framed for hurting someone or killing someone, but he said it was his clone.
Oh, no. He didn't call. That was a news story I read. There is a man who is claiming as his defense that he didn't do it, his clone did.
And how long ago did that event happen?
Not very long ago at all. That is a, in other words, it's not a concluded trial. He has presented that as his defense, and the trial hasn't even, as far as I know, occurred yet.
No, I mean, how long ago did that, murder?
No idea, sir.
Oh, because I was just wondering, I mean, if it was recent, right?
Fairly recent, I believe it is.
Well, the idea of a clone is it would be something that would be grown from an embryo.
Yes.
So how could a clone that would be maybe a couple of years old kill anybody?
Well, he's claiming the military did this. You know, secret project, that kind of thing.
Like somehow they made it clone as an adult?
Well, either that or it was done some time ago by the military. That
technology, like 20 years ago,
some black box technology, you know. That's what he's claiming.
Yeah, because it sounded to me like the point was this guy, you know, this happened only a couple of years back or something, and that he was claiming his clone supposedly did it. And I thought, wait a minute, now cloning, regardless of all the other discussions, still, it relates to raising a baby.
Well, I was wondering what it was like, you know, at the police station where probably his attorney was meeting with him, you know, and they were talking about their defense, and the guy said, look, here's what we're going with. My clone did this, and the attorney probably looked at him and went, brother, Medley, you know, of course, brother, you're going away for a long time.
Well, maybe that's the other side. Maybe they'll go with the insanity defense.
I don't know. Anyway, you never know. It's a strange world.
Well, I love your show.
I appreciate the call, sir.
Okay, thanks a lot, Art.
Take care. Wild Card Line, you are on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good evening, Art.
Hi.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about maybe a less serious subject.
Okay.
I remember hearing you talk about some really, really great pizza sauce.
Yes.
Found a long time ago.
Oh yes, it's called Pizza Punch. Yes.
Yeah. Well, uh-huh. I was wondering when you might start marketing that stuff so the rest of us can try it.
Oh, I don't know. It's one of those things that's been sort of on the back burner. It's an incredible. We discovered it in France, a little Italian restaurant in Paris. My wife and I. My wife is really, really good at deciding what's in things, and they had the ingredients of this in the bottle, and she just sat there and slowly identified the ingredients, came back home, made it. By God, she nailed it right on the head. It's the most incredible stuff on a pizza you've ever tasted. We took it, we made some just for fun, and took it to a local pizza parlor, and they went berserk over it, totally berserk. And then we sort of just backed away for a while. We've had so much other stuff going on in our life that we haven't pursued it, but that doesn't mean we won't someday. So the answer is, I don't know right now. I can't tell you. We've got so much else going on that it'd be hard to fit in, but maybe we'll get there.
Yeah, because I love pizza, and ever since I heard you talking about that sauce, I've been dying to try it. Have a good night, Art.
All right, you too, sir. Take care. Yes, well, we called it pizza punch because it's got a little punch to it. You know, it's kind of hot stuff. But boy, does it set a pizza off. It was really weird to find. What a weird place to find something like that. You know, you're in the outskirts of Paris, and here you get hungry. You know, you're walking along, doing a lot of walking in Paris, and come upon this little tiny Italian restaurant, and this fellow has this incredible stuff. Brings out this bottle, you know, plain cheese pizza, and brings out this bottle. And you put it on, and you go, oh, my God, oh, is this good? And then you sit there looking at the bottle, which you can see through, and you can see the various ingredients that are in it. And I never would have been able to pick them out, but my wife is great at that sort of thing. So, I don't know. It's one of those things that you know about, and you'll maybe do something about someday, maybe. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Turn your radio off.
Oh, yeah. Dawn, turn the radio off. I'm on. Hello?
Okay.
Proceed. All right. Actually, we're just first-time listeners.
Really?
We were just wondering, what type of show this is. You know, I mean, it's very interesting.
I wonder about it myself. I don't know. I'd say we just sort of do a lot of things here that other people don't do and talk about things other people don't talk about, that sort of
right.
thing.
Yeah, I was, because last night we were listening. And it was interesting, and it went on and on. It wasn't really something that we were mainly interested in ourselves, but it was very interesting to listen to. Well, to a certain extent, you know. Well, me not personally, but she was. That's Dawn.
Yo, Dawn.
So what it comes down to is, I was wanting to know about, like, vampires. I love hearing stuff about, I heard that caller before. I thought that was very interesting, you know, just to hear someone's opinion that you would never hear.
Did you hear the story last night about vampires in Colombia?
No, see, that's what I'm saying. Oh, see, that's they were talking about vampires last night.
In Colombia. Yeah, in Colombia. In Colombia, there are roving bands of vampires right now that are stopping people on the street at gunpoint or knife point or whatever and demanding blood from their throat.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's
wow.
Amazing. Yeah, wow. That's
it's
all
also,
I can say to that. You
it's
know?
Also it's real.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable, but believable.
it's an unusual world, sir.
It is. Actually, can I put Dawn on for a second?
Yes.
She was interested in something you were just talking about.
Okay.
Hold on.
And here comes
Hello?
Dawn. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
What are we talking about tonight? Are we talking about controlling the weather with...
No, that was last night.
That was last night. Uh-huh. Oh, are we on right now?
I sure hope so.
Oh, really? Okay. This is crazy. Oh, my God. No wonder you're on the spot late.
Yeah, I was just telling your husband about roving bands of vampires down in Colombia.
Oh. No, this whole show fascinates me. I've had so many strange occurrences since the World Trade Center and everything.
You have? Personally?
Oh, yeah, personally. Like, I don't know. I think if I channel it more, I'll be, like, clairvoyant sooner than later.
Like what? I mean...
Like, I don't know. Like, Well, it's kind of weird talking about it.
Well, we have to do that. It's a talk show here.
Yeah, recently I had an experience. I had a dream a couple of years ago, and the person that came to me in the dream turned out to be someone that has passed away in the neighborhood close to my residence. And the other night we went to the spot where I visioned in the dream, and I took a couple of friends, and they thought I was wacky, and I wound up going to that particular spot.
Yes.
And I got a real eerie feeling, and the landscape, the trees looked different right in the spot, and it was just very strange. And it turns out one of my friends looked down and seen a piece of the crime scene tape, and that's where it happened. And it was very bizarre, and it was a very, like, you know, kind of desolate area right there.
Uh-huh.
So just, like, little things like that just keep coming up, and, yeah, and I wonder, like I've been listening to your show, trying to see if other people are sharing the same experiences, and I don't know if it's just recently or...
Well, the answer to that is yes, they are, and here's where you'll hear about it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, you take care, hon.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. As I was saying earlier in the program, there's a lot of news out there that never makes it to the mainstream press. Some of what you hear here explodes into the mainstream press. We've had that happen plenty of times. But then again, a lot of it never does. It just stops. Doesn't mean it's not true. It just means that, and I often wonder about this, who it is who judges, you know, really and ultimately what goes into the news, what makes it to the news wires, what makes it to the network news half hours, that sort of thing. West of the Rockies, you're on the air without a whole lot of time. Hello.
I know. This is Andrew in Phoenix.
Yes, Andrew.
Technical question.
Yep.
About your website, since I'm in a week, I'm going to be leaving to day shift.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
1997,
I was put on night shift. Now
why don't you go and beg them not to do this to you?
Well, I have a six-month-old baby I'd like to see when she's awake.
I see.
My question is, on your website, are you able to download the show, or you
no,
have to
I,
listen?
No, I don't think you can. No, I don't think they have that ability.
I wish, because I'd be able to rip it and put it on an MP3 player and listen to it during the day.
Your choices are to record it on a recorder,
uh-huh,
or to subscribe to listen to it live on the net. But so you're not going to want to do that anyway, so that's not going to help you out. Your best shot is to record it and take it with you the next day. If they'll let you play something like this on the day shift, they'll probably run you back to nights if you play my show.
I want to be able to put it on an MP3 player.
Well, once you get it, you can put it on anything you want. Gotta go.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
Seasons don't feel the reaper, nor do the wind, the sun, or the rain. We can be like they are. Come on, baby,
don't feel the reaper.
Baby, take my hand.
Don't feel the reaper.
We'll be able to fly.
Don't feel the reaper.
Baby, I'm your man. La la la. La la la.
the sun refuses to shine. People tell me it ain't no use in trying. My little girl, you're so young and fresh. And one thing I know is true, you're gonna die before your time is due. See my daddy in bed dying. See his hair turning gray. He's been working and saving his life away. I know.
Premier Radio Networks presents Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired February 21st, 2002.
Good morning, everybody. As I said, I spent most of my, actually, adult life, early adult life, in the Far East, Okinawa, the Philippines, Vietnam, elsewhere. And this was like a theme song then.
We gotta get out of this place. If this is the last thing we ever do.
It was almost like the national anthem there, believe me. Eric Burdon and the Animals. Eric Burdon has been a musical... He's had a musical journey actually matched by very few other performers in rock music history, period. He's gone from the driving force of the grittiest British invasion band, pioneering the San Francisco psychedelic rock scene, to fronting War, the biggest funk band of the 70s, to cutting an LP with an early influence, jazz, blues, great Jimmy Witherspoon, to coming full circle, reuniting with his original band, The Animals, for a series of projects and a worldwide tour, to forming a group of, in quotes, animals, releasing a series of CDs and a recent DVD concert. Burdon's lengthy recording career began in Newcastle, England, where he first covered songs for his idols like Ray Charles, Chuck Berry, Josh White, Brownie McGee, John Lee Hooker, Jimmy Reed. He and the Animals quickly gained notoriety as England's best R&B band, were selected by the pirate station Radio Caroline as the feature for the first broadcast to the U.S. That was a ship that was offshore till they got them. They were part of the first live R&B recording in the U.K. when they joined Sonny Boy Williamson for the now-famous 63 New Year's Eve concerts. This raw performance was followed by a more polished one when the Animals appeared with Jerry Lee Lewis and Gene Vincent on Renegade Granada TV in 64 for the Whole Lot of Shakin' concert feature, released on film as Don't Knock the Rock. The film showcased their rendition of Talkin' About You. Shortly thereafter, the Animals took the music world by storm when they recorded and released an electrified version of the traditional folk number, The House of the Rising Sun. That was another one. In short fare, they followed with such classics as Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, It's My Life, I'm Crying Inside, Looking Out, The Story of Bo Diddley, Bring It On Home to Me, C.C. Rider, it goes on and on. Here, folks, from Joshua Tree is Eric Burdon, who's got a cold. Actually, the vestiges, I guess, of a cold, right, Eric?
Yeah, it's in its final stages, but... Luckily enough, my singing voice doesn't suffer. It's my speaking voice that suffers, and it gets pretty battered up from time to time. Sometimes, I'm suffering with this kind of a voice when it's not even a cold, but I've had a cold for a month. So.
And you can go out and sing like this if you have to?
Yeah, it's no problem. It's warming.
Really?
Well, you push harder, you know.
Yeah, that's what you do, is you push real hard, yeah. Don't you?
Yeah.
How much performing are you still doing? You got to be probably a couple years older than I. How old are you?
I had my 60th birthday last year.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're a few years older than I am. I'm 56.
Scary,
and,
huh?
And you're still at it. We're both still at it, really.
You're rocking, yeah.
You grew up in the shadow of World War II. What do you remember of the war and the aftermath of the war a lot?
Well, I remember, I mean, sometimes I think it's my imagination, but I remember POWs. They were dressed in British military fatigues, but they had a black diamond patch on their arms, and they would be in Woolworths and various other stores on the weekend shopping, like anybody else. Italians, Germans, Russians, and of course Americans too. I remember being taken to a USO club with my aunt, who used to serve the troops tea at a club in one of the main thoroughfares in my hometown. So that was the first time I ever heard big band jazz, and first time I ever saw black men, you know, in uniform, black men, period.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of interesting. Earlier today, I was watching a videotape of you and Otis Redding, something called Ready, Steady, Go.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you performed with black artists in Great Britain at a time when you really almost could not have done that here in America, didn't you?
Yeah, my first band, the very first band that I had before the Animals, we had two Africans. Band playing trumpet and saxophone. One is deceased a few years back. One's still alive and kicking, and we communicate with each other now and again. And they were from Ghana, and they were probably the first Africans to show up in my hometown. And they moved up to Newcastle from Manchester, which is a bigger city, bigger, much bigger than Newcastle. It's like the second biggest city in England.
That must have been a lot of influence on you then, musically, a lot of influence on you.
Well, yeah, I would follow them down to Manchester and get into a full-blown ghetto situation where, you know, where everybody was from Africa. They were all Africans or West Indians. And they had an early influence on me. My first girlfriend was African, too.
Oh, was she?
Yeah, and her brother was quite a well-known wrestler. He was the welterweight champion of England.
No
so
kidding.
For a short time, I was a roadie for a wrestler.
A roadie for a wrestler?
Yeah. Which was quite exciting for a kid of 18 years of age.
Yeah, I bet it was. So, I mean, how did the music get in you?
Well, the music was always there. I mean, I just felt like a lot of other people, unbeknownst at the time, that the same thing was happening in Liverpool and in London and Manchester and various other places where kids were going to, college and art school, and we were fed up with what we were being fed. Because we knew it wasn't the truth, and we searched for our own truth, and we found it in imported music and imported movies. So when I was at art school at Newcastle University, I spent most of my days in the movie theater watching American movies, French movies, Italian movies.
And really.
Yeah, instead of working on, you know, instead of sketching, going to art galleries and sketching things. And then I would fill in my sketchbook later on from photographs, references, and things like that, and just get away with it, you know. We formed our own band, starting out, as most kids did, as a skiffle group, which meant it was a rhythm section that grew out of the traditional jazz bands that were popular at the time in England, like Chris Barber who kind of really was the father of the English, eventually the English rock and roll scene, because his traditional jazz band was the first, he was the first band leader to allow the rhythm section to, during a musical break, to have, break out the guitars, keep the banjo on stage, lose the drummer, lose the horn section, and then a guy who played banjo for Chris Barber's band, Lonnie Donegan, would step up front and do things like Rock Island Lion, and he named himself after Lonnie Johnson. So that was the first...
Did you say Lonnie Donegan?
Lonnie Donegan, yeah.
Wasn't that the Lonnie Donegan of chewing gum?
Yeah.
Was it really? Does your chewing gum lose its flavor?
Its flavor on the
toast overnight. Yeah, that's right. Listen, I forgot to do a break, so let me do a break. We'll come right back to you. Lonnie Donegan. Oh, boy, do I remember that name. Eric Burden's here. We'll be right back.
Now we take you back to the night of February 21st, 2002, on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
I should have done that break right at the beginning. I was so anxious to get started here that I just blew right by it, as I frequently do. Back to Eric Burden. Hey, Eric, a lot of the bands that finally became the, you know, the British invasion here, were they sort of all roughly forming up at about the same time?
Absolutely. I mean, it was a total surprise and shock to me to go down to London to a club called Alexis Corner Club, which was named after a guy called Alexis Corner, who... started the first R&B bands in England, and stand there in the crowd and look around and see Mick and Keith and Brian Jones and Ronnie Jones and Gino Washington. The latter guys were two Americans who'd been in the U.S. Air Force in England and decided to stay because the scene was so groovy. Then, of course, the Beatles
hit the
world. You know, they came out of Hamburg with already about 200 songs written already, and then went to the studio and had the producer refine them, and that's how they came up with so many hit songs.
Well, what I'm curious about is why something like that happens. I mean, there it is, rock scenes trucking along in this country, and nobody knows it, but building in Europe is this incredible, incredible invasion, and it's happening all over the place, not just you, not just the Beatles, but so many, all happening at the same time, all ready to break over our heads over here like a giant wave, and it seems so unlikely, or maybe it isn't, you know, that it would all be happening roughly at the same time.
Yeah, well, it's all down to timing. I mean, everything's timing. You can have everything on your side in any facet of life, and if you haven't got timing, you're dead in the water. And there was it was just the coming out of the war years, coming out of the black and whiteness of the war years, and trying to inject some life into this stuffy British, you know, claustrophobic lifestyle. You know, suddenly kids had money for the first time. We had our own money, and we cracked our own dress styles. Long before the Beatles came on the scene with the Beatle haircuts and everything, there was the Edwardian Teddy Boys who wore Edwardian suits with purple drapes, and the jacket had to be thumb length, the stovepipe pants, and huge thick crepe sole shoes, you know, and the girls were called Black Angels, and they wore pencil thin skirts, ballet shoes, and their weaponry was metal combs stuck in their beehive head with sharpened edges. So you had to watch out for those bad girls.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I saw a lot of those girls in this videotape earlier today, and it really took me back. Boy, those hairdos in the 60s, aye, aye, aye. But the girls, you know what, you're looking back at them now, even on videotape, they still look good, Aaron.
Oh, yeah, sharp. Everybody was sharp. That was the thing, was to be sharp, you know.
Yeah.
And then the music just cut through because I remember coming to New York, and when I first hit the streets of New York, and I met this guy on the street, and he said, I remember I stopped and looked at him because he had one shoe on. He had a shoe missing. And he said, "You want to have English bands?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Man, people love a beat. In America, people love anything with a beat."
That's right.
And of course, everybody in the world loves everything with a beat. And the one thing that I remember about being afraid to tell my parents what I was doing at night, instead of night schools, I was going to a jazz club.
Oh, you mean they didn't know?
No. So I took my father along with me one night.
Uh-huh.
He thought it was wonderful.
He did?
Yeah. They all thought it was wonderful.
And you told him you hadn't exactly been doing what he thought you'd been doing, right?
No, but we made a promise, you know, don't tell your mother, and as long as you get your work done on the side, then you can come here whenever you want, as long as you don't fail to deliver in your studies. So I had my parents trained at an early age.
I would have been terrified, and I don't think it would have worked out that well for me at all. My parents were both Marines, Eric.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, uh-oh is right. And they were, you talk about strict.
Well, my family, I was lucky. My family was split right down the middle. First of all, my mother was from Scotland. My father was English. My father was actually in World War II a conscientious objector. And my mother's side of the family were all military. And there was an adopted uncle in the family who was Catholic. And the family was English Presbyterian, basically. So there was this mishmash of living on the borderline of England and Scotland. And I must admit that the Scottish side of me was more important, meant more to me than the English side of me. There seemed to be more to Scotland, more pride in Scotland, more violence as well in Scotland, but also a regal feel to Edinburgh when I used to go there. And every night I would go to bed and listen to the military bagpipes on the hill piping the end of the day at 9 o'clock every night. And that just soaked right into, you know, right through the pores of my skin and stayed with me right up till today. I never forgot it.
What is it? Do you have any idea what it is about music that is so important to every human being? So important. I mean, it's just, it's like it's magic.
Well, I really do believe that there is magic in music. I mean, it does have healing powers. I think that the people of the East, particularly in India, they really know more about the healing power of music than we do. But what made the music of my generation so important was it had gone electric. And when you make electric music, it goes through the skin, it goes to the bone.
It goes
right
to the bone.
I call it bone music.
Yes, that's right, it's bone music.
Yeah. And you can't dismiss it.
Yeah, no, it's magic. And it's really, although I'm not on your side, so I don't know what it's like performing it, but my guess is the magic is there the same way for the person who performs it as those who listen. It's the same magic, isn't it?
Well, maybe even more so. I mean, I always say that the space between the stage and the performer, if you take a photograph of it, a Polaroid photograph of it, and take the Polaroid slide out of the camera and look art what develops. You'll see the audience, and you'll see the stage and the performers, and between them nothing but space and light.
Right.
But actually, I think that space is filled with spirituality.
All kinds of energy. Oh, tons of energy.
Yeah.
Tons of energy. God, it is. It's magic. And so then being up there, being on stage, you think it might even be a little more magical. I mean, you're projecting, right?
Oh, yeah. There are certain gigs, certain places, at certain times, of course, that are just overwhelming. When I think of the best gigs that I've ever done, I always think of Paris, Athens. There's a club in Athens which...
You know when you're in the zone, right?
Yeah. You just look out there and you see these faces lit up, you know, eyes wide open. Everybody's just lit up by what you're doing.
That's it. Well, Eric, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. I've got Eric Burden here. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002. Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
Eric Burden is here tonight, now. And in a moment, we'll get right back to him. So much to ask.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
Once again, here is Eric Burden. Eric, you formed the Animals. How'd that happen? How did it all come together?
It was a conglomeration of several bands that were playing in my hometown, Newcastle. And Alan Price was recruited as piano player. Charles Chandler, the oldest member of the band, was the bass player. Hilton Valentine, the guitar player. John Steele, drummer. John Steele and I went to art school together and formulated jazz outfits and at college. And then we started listening to jukeboxes and listening to blues, rhythm and blues, and of course Elvis Presley, people like that, and realized that that was what we really were wanting to, you know.
Presley was a big influence?
Absolutely. I think, you know, Elvis really saved black music. Well, people will admit that or not, that's what I believe. Black music wouldn't have survived if it hadn't been for Elvis Presley.
He was a big influence on Beatles, too, of course.
Yeah, I think on everybody.
On everybody.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Elvis is... I've heard people say that Elvis was just a phenomenon and that he really didn't contribute or create anything special. But I think the one thing that Presley did for all of us was he made it safe for us to say it's all right to feel good. It's all right to feel sexual. You know, it's all right to feel groovy. And
What was it like? You know, during a lot of the years that you were doing that, I was top 40 disc jockey. I was in the Air Force. I was overseas. I was a disc jockey. I played that music when you were making it. And I remember the women really well, Eric. And I was just a disc jockey. And I remember the women. And I can't even imagine what it must have been like for you.
Well, I mean, basically, that's why guys got in bands and groups. It's the quickest way to the girls. You know? Just you'd go to a rehearsal room and plug up the amplifiers and crack up a couple of tunes, and you know, girls would wander in off the street just with their mouths dropped in.
Yes.
Wow, what's going on here?
And other things. And so, you know, now that you're older, and you look back on all of that, all of those years, how do you feel about it now? Any regrets or just really good memories or both?
Great memories. I have a few regrets. You know, I probably wouldn't cough up on the radio with them. Basically, I'd say I don't have any regrets. I think I've had a great life. I am still having a great life. In fact, probably having a better time now than I've ever had because I'm more aware of what I'm doing now. And I like myself better now, you know. For years, I had trouble with myself, you know. It was like, I grew up thinking it was hip to be uptight, or hip to be tough, or, you know, the rebel, you know, the whole need to be, I was going to say James Dean, but James Dean never portrayed the bad rebel. I always thought he was a great rebel. I always thought he was a very feeling person. But as soon as we saw Marlon Brando, you know, with the dark glasses on, the leather jacket with Johnny scrawled on it, and the wild one, this is where the story started for me, on a two-lane blacktop outside of, you know, we were there. I mean, you wanted to go, well, I wanted to go to America and be as bad as I could possibly be, you know. Of course, you know, you got to learn from those lessons.
Well, I mean, now you're in your, you made it to your 60s, but boy, an awful lot of you all haven't made it that far at all. So many. And I know you knew one of them very well, Jimi Hendrix, huh?
Yeah, it's so sad, you know, to see so much talent and in the prime of life with seemingly everything going for him.
Was he a good friend of yours?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, I don't know how close anybody could really get to Jimmy. I mean, he was a bit of a loner, as well as, you know, the girls would come first, you know. You know, LSD and girls came first, and performance came first. Nothing else mattered. I never saw the guy without his guitar for the first few years that I knew him. In fact, the first time I saw him without his guitar in public, at a party in London,
mm-hmm.
and he was without his guitar, that's when I knew he was in trouble and things were changing for him. And he was beginning to feel trapped. because he was being used and utilized, and he was a stranger in a strange land. But we, there was one or two friends who felt his predicament and wanted to help him over it and help him through it.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the same thing that happened to Presley. You know, he was
absolutely
isolated because he was used. It got to the point where he was angry at everything, didn't trust anybody, and retreated to a world of drugs. And anyway, you knew at that point that Hendrix was probably lost.
Well, we had a mutual friend in Roland Kirk, Rassan Roland Kirk, who was probably one of the greatest living musicians ever. And he was blind, and because he was blind, I think he could see a lot more than most of us.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me to tell Jimmy, you know, that he was doing too much. He was seeing too much. You got to get across to him that, you know, you can't see that much. And I said, yeah, of course I'll do what I can, knowing that there was no way that I could reach Jimmy on that level. And I tried to warn him about the business end of things because I was managed by the same people. So I knew the same thing was going to happen to Jimmy as it happened to me. And I tried to take him aside and also his bass player, Noel Redding. I tried to tell both of them what was going to happen, what was going to transpire. But by that time, he was king of the world, you know. And stoned most of the time, and just refused to acknowledge anybody, anything by that time.
Out of control.
I wouldn't say out of control. Because
his own control. I mean,
he was in control.
Or I guess doing what he wanted to do.
Yeah, in control of his guitar. I mean, how could you say Hendrix was out of control? Here was a guy who could play two guitars at once, and thump the bass with his feet, and sing as well.
No, I didn't mean that way at all.
Yeah.
I didn't mean out of control like that.
Yeah, but that takes a lot of intense self-control to be able to pull that off. But he'd created this role for himself, and it was impossible to step back from the burning of the guitars and the reputation of two, three girls a night, whatever. But I really believe that there was an inner person that I knew, because he would come over to my house and over to my apartment, knock on the door, and just say, "I've had enough of that stuff, man. Let's just kick back and listen to some music." Because I had a great stereo system, and we'd listen to everything from classical music to his latest demo tapes that he'd bring over to my house. So we formed a pretty close relationship on that level, and it was pretty bizarre how I got pulled into his demise, into his death, because I hadn't seen him for about a year. I'd given up on trying to reach him, and I came into London, and his road manager said, "Jimmy wants to see you." And my reaction was, "Well, if he wants to see me, he'll come and find me."
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew that would draw him out of his self-imposed exile. He was hiding out in a hotel and with a current girlfriend. And I was playing at Ronnie Scott's Club in London. And he did. It worked. He came across the door.
Did you know the girl?
Did it? Sorry?
Did you know the girl?
No, I'd never seen her before.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I understood that they were an item, so to speak. And but I didn't know that he just met her on a recent German tour. And the first night he came and jammed with me, he was in a terrible state. And I sort of could smell heroin, you know. I thought it was smack he was into, and I was totally disgusted, and I told him to go away. Come back the next night. He came back the next night, and he was totally straight. And he jammed with my band with War, and I got the feeling from him on stage that night that he realized that that's where he should have been. This is the place he should be, with a band of, you know, black brothers jamming and having a good time. And the last time I saw him, he had a smile on his face. But he was dead 2 days later.
But dead 2 days later. See, that doesn't sound like somebody who was going to go commit suicide.
No, it doesn't. But in my first book, I did theorize that it was a suicide because I thought that he was so depressed. And I found a letter by his bedside, which to me read exactly like a suicide note. So I assumed that it was a possible suicide, or he'd just gone too far and couldn't pull out of the dive. But after doing much research and looking at every interview that was ever done with his girlfriend at the time, I think now that I was wrong, and I've come up with a different
What do you now believe?
Theory. Well, I should say one should read my new book to find that out, because, you know, I don't want to give it away. I want people to read it in black and white from off the page. A lot of research went into this. And
well, reading between the lines is not real hard. In other words, you let's put it this way, you probably think something other than you originally did before the research, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I read the coroner's report, so interviews with the doctor. He wasn't rescue able. They wheeled him right into the waiting area to the next step was the morgue.
The girl you mentioned, that they were an item, she later, I've heard, committed suicide herself, is that correct?
Yeah. It's pretty dark. It's pretty dark stuff. And it killed me. It killed my career. I mean, but it didn't kill me physically. I'm still here, thank God.
Killed your career?
But it put the blade in my career in England. I was told after I'd done an interview for the BBC, I was told by a record company executive that I would never work in England again. And I haven't since 1971. I'm going back to do a tour there this summer, and that'll be my first appearance in all that time.
Why would they blame you?
I don't think they blamed me. I think that it was like, you guys did a whole bunch of drugs together and you had a great time, and one of you fell off your bike and crashed and broke your neck, and the one who survived is going to cop all the guff that goes with it.
Yeah.
So I was just like humped in as like I was his junko partner, and that's the way it, you know, it made great stuff for the press.
Were you?
Where was I?
Were you his junkie partner?
No. I mean, I never, ever used heroin. I would never, ever use heroin. And I think that is to jump from Jimmy and that period of time to the present day. I think that's one of the biggest problems we face in the world today, is that every government, you know, every political entity, they all look at the word drugs and they hump it all together in one piece and say drugs are bad, period.
Yeah, I know.
Well, it's not quite as clear as that. It's not quite as clear cut as that.
No, not at all.
Some drugs will save your life and some drugs will kill you.
Yeah, and some drugs probably will help you through life and some drugs will hurt you badly. You know, it's a whole spectrum. You're right. I mean, they lump it all together, and they even throw marijuana in there too. So
absolutely, it's you know, I really believe that if they'd have legalized marijuana in the United States in the 70s, in the early 70s, I think that it would have affected other countries to follow suit, and we would have had a soft core alternative for the younger generation to turn to other than alcohol, because each generation always wants an alternative. away from what the previous generation had.
Yeah, alcohol, and it's, pot,
and it's a
whatever.
Soft, it's a soft alternative to alcohol, and it's a livable. It has. I don't know any case of anybody dying by inhaling marijuana.
No. No, indeed not. And when you lump it in with everything right up to and including heroin, then the little kid who's going to try it for the first time after hearing every commercial in the world tell him, you know, he'll go mad or whatever, he's been lied to once now, he figures.
Yeah.
So it's really easy to take that next step.
We all know that. You tell kids not to do something, and it's the first thing they're going to do. I mean, that's just the way kids are. So we have to educate them and guide them, not prohibit them and punish them. I think we've got it all around the wrong way, and that's why we're in trouble.
How much were drugs, any kind of drugs, how much did they influence you and your music?
God, a hell of a lot. I mean, LSD was a revelation to me. I mean, I took LSD not because it was a narcotic. And it restricted you from doing things.
Well, it's not a narcotic.
It did the opposite.
Yeah.
It opened up my mind to the possibilities of everything. In fact, I moved out here to the desert to Joshua Tree, where I now live, originally because it was a UFO center. It was the place where you came to gaze at the stars at night and take a psychedelic to enhance that, which is unfortunate now because it cancels out any visions that I've had of lights moving across the sky at night because I was stoned at the time. But it doesn't make any difference. I saw them. I know what I saw.
You know what you saw. Believe me, we're going to talk about that. By the way, I don't live all that far from you. I'm in a little place called Pahrump, Nevada, which is just kind of like where you are, actually. It's very
desert.
Serious desert. High desert, yeah. And it's also known, you know, I'm just right across the mountain range here from that place called Area 51.
Oh, yeah.
Dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 is right. And people see here things here all the time, and I've seen them too.
Yeah.
And so you came to the desert for that reason?
Yeah, when I think back, yeah, I think so. You know, I was living in Los Angeles, and I'd come out the desert for weekends. made friends with Steve McQueen. Did a lot of off the road and dune buggy dirt.
Steve did
with Steve.
Yeah, he did a lot of that, didn't he?
Yeah.
Hold on, we're at the top of the hour, so just rest for a bit.
As they stand in line.
This would be from about that period.
The smell of gun grease. And their bayonets, they shine. He's there to help them all that he can.
Remember yet?
To make them feel wanted, he's a good holy man.
Good morning. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
Sky!
This following program is dedicated to the city and people of San Francisco, who may not know it, but they are beautiful, and so is their city. This is a very personal song, so if the viewer cannot understand it, particularly those of you who are European residents, save up all your bread and fly Translove Airways to San Francisco, USA. Then maybe you'll understand the song. It will be worth it. If not for the sake of this song, but for the sake of your own peace of mind.
Strobe lights beam, creates dreams. Walls move, minds do too. On a wall, San Franciscan night. Old child, young child, feel alright. On a warm
San Franciscan night. Angels sing, leather wings, jeans of blue, Harley Davidson's tree. On a warm San Franciscan night, old angel, young angel, feel alright. On a warm San Franciscan night.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
It is that. Eric Burden is my guest, and
San Francisco.
We'll be right back.
Now we take you back to the night of February 21st, 2002, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Before I leave the subject of Jimi Hendrix and everything, there's one more, a couple aspects I want to cover. One is, during those years, we've got into the Vietnam War, and things were pretty crazy here in America, and a lot of people think that Jimi was on a list, probably regarded as a national security threat, along with a lot of other people at the time, and I wonder if you're aware of that, or whether you've considered that or know it for a fact.
Well, yeah, I think that he could have been considered a danger in certain areas. He was, I don't know if you know it, but he was kidnapped.
Kidnapped?
Yeah.
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, kidnapped at gunpoint.
By?
Well, read my book. Yeah, but that's a fact. He was kidnapped. When I was told about it, I immediately knew the M.O. And who was
behind it. Yeah.
But his management towards the end got involved in some very dodgy characters. He was a sort of wannabe mafia type. And although I don't think the mafia were directly involved.
That was going to be my next question. About the mafia, about organized crime.
Well, organized crime basically stayed away from music. I mean, who would want to manage a rock star? I mean, it ain't easy.
No, but there wasn't a lot of money flying around.
Yeah, but jukeboxes and clubs and stuff like that, and record distribution is another total different aspect, a way of reaping money. So, of course, there was involvement on that level. Always has been, wherever there's money to be made. In huge amounts, but I could be wrong. I don't know, because I haven't seen Hendrix's FBI file or whatever, but he was projected towards the end as a sort of peace warrior, peace leader, and just around the time he departed, there was a standoff at Wounded Knee with Lakota Indians.
I remember it. Yeah.
And we had, tanks up against painted ponies. And it was just incredible imagery. And I think that if Hendrix had have lived, he certainly could have gotten sucked into that vacuum, because he had Indian blood to start with. And where he got his knowledge from in his early years, and he certainly knew a lot about Indian philosophy, Indian practices, the belief in the four winds, the belief in the animal contact, and receiving messages from animals, and chasing storm clouds, and all this kind of stuff. This was a guy who'd just been in the U.S. military. I was like, wow, where did he get all this from?
Where'd it all come from, yeah.
And I just found out recently that he often took advice from a great Indian shaman, Rolling Thunder. And I'm now friends with Rolling Thunder's grandson.
Oh.
His name is Elk Thunder. And Elk Thunder has told me that Hendrix often would meet and converse with Rolling Thunder for strength and well-being and health and direction and all that goes with it. So if you look at that AIM situation, that American Indian movement that happened in the 1971 through the 73-74, where there was a lot of the hippies, white hippies, were being influenced by the Indian movement, and although, you know, the Indians weren't that too happy about that, they didn't say no. They felt that, you know, it was power to their cause to see these young white kids,
sure,
copying their dress styles and getting the sweat lodges and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, there was these charismatic leaders that developed, Russell Means, Dennis Banks, Leonard Peltier, who went to jail and I think is still
right.
in jail.
Yep.
And all they needed was a definite power and a definite force to rally people to their cause, and Hendrix would have definitely would have been the guy for that.
Well, again, apparently in 79, some college students, University of Santa Barbara, filed for release of some of the FBI files on Hendrix. Well, they got back.
Blank, blank, blank.
Blank, 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 blacked out stuff. So they were really, really interested in Mr. Hendrix, really interested.
Yeah, and I mean, it's difficult, you know, I haven't forgotten that history will show that that standoff at Wounded Knee was the largest armed conflict on U.S. soil since the Civil War.
How about you? Have you had any run-ins with officialdom?
Not really, other than when I headed for Wounded Knee in 72, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go to Pine Ridge to witness what was going on there because I thought it was such an American event. I thought it was history in the making. And I got as far as, I think it was the Idaho state line, and I was told in no uncertain terms by these gentlemen in this, standing by this unmarked car,
that you weren't going to go any further.
That I should not go any further, and they were pretty pressing about it.
So they knew you were coming.
I don't think no, I was coming, but I just think they were turning everybody around. So I literally turned around and went to Mexico, and I stayed in Mexico, drove around Mexico, went down to Belize and Honduras, and when I came back, I really thought that America wasn't going to be there when I got back, because the imagery that in my head as I left was just total, you know, close to absolute civil unrest. And but, you know, as luck would have it, and once again timing came into play, Richard Nixon's tapes came to light, and that put everything on the back burner, and the standoff at Wounded Knee and all that were involved were forgotten completely.
Probably most of the FBI files and the government surveillance, rather than Wounded Knee, most of it was probably because of the anti-war movement, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, of course. That was, you know, that's always a trigger mechanism to go deeper into someone's life. But, you know, I think that probably Jimmy was being watched. I mean, I know for sure John Lennon was. I mean, I was amazed what John did when he got involved with Yoko. I mean, I'll never forget.
Did you know Bill, you knew John?
Yeah, quite well. I'll never forget billboards on Sunset Boulevard in big, huge black and white letters that said, "War is over now if you want it."
Mm-hmm.
Says John and Yoko, you know. And this was when the Vietnam War was still raging away. I mean, I think it was 72 or whatever.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even a citizen. So he was definitely throwing rocks in a glass house. And he lived next to me in Bel Air for a few months. And I always wanted to try and talk to him just because he was a homeboy, you know, just because he was a homie. You know? And we were the same age, and both from Northern England. But he just wouldn't show up. And he'd send books to me. He'd send books over with his chauffeur and drop various books off that he thought I should read. And I remember one was inscribed, "Dear Eric, becoming an American won't ease the pain." Signed, John and Yoko.
What do you know of what happened with John and Yoko and the whole breakup and the whole mess?
Well, John needed a woman. You know? He needed a strong woman in his life. That was the one thing that was missing in his world. And Yoko, or whatever anybody thinks about her, she fit the bill. And she told him that there was life beyond the Beatles. And in effect, broke up the Beatles in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But their love affair came first, and at that point in time, the Beatles came second. So you have to put that in perspective. She was hated for doing that, but she and John had become this, artist and muse, man and wife, lovers, whatever, political and politically oriented people with their bed in demonstrations and so forth.
You know, kind of odd in a way for an Oriental woman to be that strong, that political, that involved, that...
She's a New Yorker.
Socially kind. Well, still, I know, but there's roots.
Yeah.
Usually there's roots.
Yeah. But it, she did change his life, and for a while, he was very happy. You could see that he was extremely happy. For the first time in his life, he lost weight, because he always hated being pointed at as the Beatle who would get fat first, the pudgy guy,
Yeah.
And if you look back at those videos that they made in New York, he was slimmed down and, dressed differently, and the hair suddenly was cut, to a GI, military style cut, and he was happy. He was in New York. He didn't get bothered by people, but he got stalked.
Do you remember how many rumors there were of the Beatles getting back together? And some of them real strong, and sure, it was real close a couple times, I think. Do you know why it didn't happen?
Well, basically because of the threat from Charlie Manson, I think.
Charlie Manson?
Well, Charles Manson took the White Album and made that his Bible. Well, was it Helter Skelter, right?
Right.
And made that his Bible. And used LSD to program his crew to do whatever he wanted to do. I would probably think that Charlie didn't do acid. He got his crew to do acid, but he didn't. And he was a failed musician, a failed artist.
When you
and
see
beware
Charlie.
Of failed artists. Yeah, I mean, Hitler was a failed artist.
Yeah, that's right. When you see Charlie today, he still looks like... I don't know. I've seen interviews with Charlie, and he looks like the most evil. It's like the most evil thing I've ever seen in my whole life. You can look and listen to him, and it'll send chills down your back just listening to him.
Well, one can't forget the threat that came from that camp against everybody, but particularly against the Beatles, because they must have got the feeling that if they ever performed again live, that somebody might be out there with a gun.
You think
somebody
that's
somebody was out there with a gun?
Somebody was there, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
You think that's what stopped them from doing it again?
That and that they'd had enough. They were sensible enough to say, we've done it all. We've taken it as far as you can. George wanted to get into his Eastern religious philosophy.
Right.
He was gone. John was gone in New York. By that time, Yoko had taught him how to become a working artist and put his work, his artwork into perspective and begin to sell it on the market. In fact, she's still doing that now. And Paul was in love and had a wonderful life with his missus up in, on their farm in Scotland. And,
he sure did.
And he had the courage, Paul had the courage enough to take his woman into his band with him so that she could be everywhere with him. And he was, you know, I can remember how much he was slighted by musicians and laughed at by musicians at the time for doing that. But I thought that was a courageous thing to do. But they all, you got to remember that the Beatles lost the best years of their lives to being the band, the Beatles. And they desperately, after it was over, after the break came between, basically between John and Paul, they desperately wanted to have their own lives. I mean, that's understandable.
Yeah, it is. It is. But, you know, somehow also understandable would be, you know, after enough years have gone by, just to sort of get together again and see if the magic's still there.
No, well, I tend to argue with that because I went through band reunions and I hated it.
You hated it?
I hated every minute of it. I mean, back to my opening statement about timing being important. You can't turn back the clock like that. You know, it's the magic of the moment.
Passes?
Yeah. And it's the same with the drug culture. I wouldn't argue for LSD today. It's not what it was. I'm not who I was.
No,
your
of course
body's not.
Not
what it was.
Of course not.
And the environment around you isn't what it was. So it was just something that happened at that peak, that pinnacle of time, you know. And we were convinced that we could change the world. We were convinced that we could stop all wars. We were convinced that music had that power. And unfortunately, it was just a dream. And it was John Lennon that said in 1971, the dream is over.
A lot of people in America then, and in wartime, and I was over there, so I wasn't here. I wasn't part of this. I was over there doing that, you understand. But a lot of people thought John Lennon was a communist.
Was a communist?
Yeah, communist.
I don't think so. I don't think he even was aware of what basic, you know, Marxist teachings was or whatever. He was, John was too much of a humanist, and he was a reactionary, for sure. And, you know, when I first met him, he was a bit of a street thug, you know. I mean, I remember him being very tough when he came out of Liverpool.
You had to be tough to be in that part of Liverpool.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, that's partly what the drug culture did. It changed a lot of people. It turned a lot of people instantly into the desire for peace. And I think that the greatest thing that rock and roll music aspired to was the period during the mid-60s through to the mid-70s where it became an international peace movement and was accepted as such throughout the world, and it's never gotten back to that.
But it was the words of what he sang. We're at the bottom of the hour. It was the words of what he sang that made people think that. Maybe they just took it the wrong way. But you know, if you listen carefully,
you're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks tonight. An encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
You try. Yeah. Don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be bad. Baby, sometimes I'm so carefree with a joy that's hard to hide. And sometimes it seems that all I have to do is worry, and then you're bound to see my other side. Understood. If I seem edgy, I want you to know that I never mean to take it out on you. Life has its problems, and I get my share, and that's one thing I never mean to do, 'cause I love you. Oh, 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 baby, don't you know I'm human? I have thoughts like any other one. Sometimes I find myself long regretting some foolish thing, some sinful thing I've done.
Premier Radio Networks presents Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired February 21st, 2002.
My guest is Eric Burden. That's the title of his new book, by the way. We'll be right back.
Now we take you back to the night of February 21st, 2002, on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
If you listen to the words of John's song, and you approach communism as just an ideal, you know, a perfect ideal, which I suppose if it was implemented perfectly, it might have been, then that's what he was singing about. But he was just an idealist, wasn't he?
I think John Lennon's communist experience, if he had one, was probably being a member of the Beatles, and he found out it didn't work. But I think that the John's stance, if he had one, and what shaped his character was the fact his mother was run down by a policeman in Liverpool when he was a kid. And from that point on, he hated any form of
authority.
Authoritarian.
Yeah.
And I think that probably shaped him more than anything.
I guess I'm kind of curious. You make comments about UFOs and being in the desert and all the rest of it. Had you heard my program before?
No, I hadn't. I heard about it, but
you knew about it, so you never heard it.
Never had chance to receive it. I'm always traveling, and I'm glad that you're there. I always keep think of the human mind as a parachute. It's only going to work if it's open. And
that's right.
Whether one believes in UFOs or not, I always throw UFOs out in conversations just to find out how open people are.
Well, you said you knew what you saw. What did you see?
Fast-moving lights in the sky. Like a star, but making erratic...
Erratic movements.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, out here, I've seen a lot of stuff that people have been freaked out by, but I've known that it was the military here locally with their... jump jets, you know, the Harrier jump jets, and the wind's going in the opposite direction, and it makes them look super ghostly because you don't hear the noise of the engines.
Well, you got interested in that kind of thing. You also got interested in the Integratron somehow or another, didn't you?
Well, yeah, it's just down the road from me. And I discovered that place when Van Tassel was still alive, I believe. And I never did get to meet him, but I know people who did meet him. And,
What did you hear about the Integratron then when you saw it, when you went to it? What was your experience?
Well, I just thought it was an incredible structure, you know, for anybody to build. And I did a bit of reading on who Van Tassel was. George Van Tassel was Howard Hughes' chief test pilot.
Right.
And I don't know if that's true or not, but I think he was in the German Air Force in World War II. But I don't know whether that's true or not. But this this whole area is filled with a lot of mysticism and stories. I mean, it's true that there was a high-ranking German officer who lived in the shadow of Big Rock, which is right next to the Integratron. And it's this Big Rock is the biggest boulder in the world. And it suddenly just split about 2 years ago, right down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And makes me wonder, because it's right next to 29 Palms Marine Base. But no, the local explanation for its splitting is that it was hot engines from four-wheel drives pulling in there to camp.
Is that right?
Middle of the night. But this boulder is bigger than Ayers Rock, and it split. So that's one of the local mysteries. But the Integratron stands is the most fascinating one, because a couple of ladies have taken it over and refurbished it back to its supposedly original state. But, of course, nobody can come up with Von Tassel's theory of rejuvenation, which is what he said he learned from an alien abduction.
So, and when you were in its when you were there, did it feel that way to you? I mean, things feel a certain way.
Well, I walked into the place after he was dead and gone, and it had been left to wreck and ruin. But it's a magnificent structure, and I think it's a hexagonal. I'm not sure. It's a dome. It's a white dome. And there are pipes running around the walls high up about what would be a story, about a house, a regular house story and a half. And there are brass and copper pipes running around the inside of the building. And his theory was if you run a sort of osmosis kind of system through there, that it would have a rejuvenating effect on humans.
Well, we live in a very strange world where not all things are perfectly understood, that's for sure.
Yeah, but it's still there, and it's become quite a tourist attraction now. And but I would really like to know more or find out more about Von Tassel, but there isn't that much in print on about him.
Well, why do you think that so many artists like yourself, like the Beatles, like so many more, went on quests, you know, really serious spiritual quests? Did the music lead you that way, or what part of being in that life led people in that direction, do you think?
Well, I'm guilty of using drugs for that. I mean, that's what I used LSD, mescaline, peyote for. Because I believe, in my mind, if there are aliens, I believe that it's a psychic phenomena.
It may be.
And that it's all in the dark recesses of every human's brain. And all that lysergic acid does, actually, is it opens up the pineal gland between the large part of the brain and the small part of the brain. So it just reorganizes everything you see. Everything you look at is reorganized.
The problem with that is, though, unless that's what's projecting it, because a lot of people, you know, like people who don't do drugs, cops I've interviewed, law enforcement people, you know, really pilots who've had near collisions with UFOs, those kind of people, you know, maybe they're the recipients of, you know, what's being projected. If it's all from us, that's all I can imagine, because they certainly wouldn't be projecting it.
No, well, I mean, there are people that need the drug experience, and there are people that don't need it. I mean, look at the work of Salvador Dali. He didn't take drugs, but his painting concepts are certainly psychedelic.
All natural, huh?
Yeah.
You know, piece of bumper music that I played a little while ago, Gordon Lightfoot, Sundown.
I love that.
Yeah, I do too. I interviewed Gordon. And, you know, Gordon, he sang about his life. I mean, you could ask him about the various songs he sang, and, you know, that stuff came straight from his life, and a lot of it was really troubled, and a lot of it was really troubled with women, and I think that's where a lot of music comes from, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think that's where a lot of our problems in really understanding who we are comes from. We don't give the female side of our lives enough credit for being, you know, probably stronger than males in a lot of
probably
ways.
Oh, probably, yes.
And in ancient cultures, it was always the grandmother who was the ultimate shamanistic figure that everybody went to for advice. You know, we've lost sight of that, and even the women's movement, they've lost sight of that. I think that in trying to copy what men are, they're off on the wrong track. They're supposed to set an example for us. So that, you know, I mean, we play with guns. We play with explosives. We create wars. We make war on each other. Why should a woman want to copy that and become a part of that?
Yeah, well, they generally don't.
Lead us on a different direction, I believe.
Why did you call your book? It's a good title. It's a great title, of course. Don't let me be misunderstood. But why that title? What? How'd you decide on that?
I didn't. The book company.
Ah.
They stuck it on me.
Does it fit?
Yeah, I think it fits. Yeah, I think it fits a lot. Yeah, I think there's a lot of times in my life that I've been misunderstood and misread. But that's okay, you know. That's all right. I don't expect everybody to read me clearly, see exactly what I am and who I am.
How much danger, you know, obviously for John, for a lot of others, there was really, there was danger. I mean, there was stalking. They couldn't, after being that famous, even years later, even in later life, you know, even in other marriages, they were never safe. Never safe. And
you know, what you're up against as an artist, you're up against incredible things. I mean, just, I meet people on a day-to-day basis who say, oh, Eric Burdon, yeah, wow, yeah, you used to be great. Or, you know, yeah, you know, I thought you were dead.
Oh, people say that.
That's one of the ongoing favorite ones. Or I'll get into a conversation on the political front with somebody at a bar, and my politics will be directly the opposite to them, and I'll go to the men's room and come back, and the barman's told them who I am, and they'll say, I'm sorry, man, I wouldn't have said that if I hadn't known it was you. And I just, like, get really disgusted with people like that. I mean, come on. It's really amazing how flashed out people can get around fame. Fame is a bitch. It really is.
People don't understand that.
It is really tough to deal with. And I've made a life out of snaking my way through the ups and downs of life and being able to keep my own private life to myself and not be splashed all over the tabloids, and yet move in the world of rock and roll. And
that's not easy.
No, it's not. But it can be done. It can be done. And being small in stature helps, because I can get out of any place. To hell with security. I don't need security. I can get out of anywhere.
Have there been many times in your career when you've been worried enough to, you know, admit the security?
Well, there's been times when I've gotten myself into situations where security was the problem. And nobody could help me. I was arrested in Germany for terrorist acts against the state under the Emergency Powers Act.
Really?
Yeah.
What did they think you had done?
I was making a movie, and the director had gone to university with top German terrorists, and a judge wanted to be the guy to put it all to bed, put it all to rest, because during the 70s and 80s, this particular terrorist gang, the Bader-Meinhof gang, had held the West German state to ransom. They were created mayhem. Explosions, assassinations, setting places on fire and all that. And the director of the movie that I made had gone to school with the female partner of this Bonnie and Clyde kind of outfit. And so anybody who was a part of that was roped in, and it was guilt by association. And
that's got to be pretty scary stuff.
It scared the living daylights out of me, and I go into that experience in depth in my book, because I want people to understand how bad it is when you're judged wrongly, when you're Henry Fonda in The Wrong Man.
Yeah,
it's not a great thing to go through.
Well, a lot of people wish for fame, and I've told them frequently, you know, you really should be very careful what you wish for, because fame isn't all it's really cracked up to be.
No, it's not. No, it's not. There are, you know, like I say, I've managed to walk a fine line between fame and keep a private life, but there are times when, there's times when it works too, you know. Oh, excuse me, officer, I didn't realize I was, oh, yeah, you are the sky pilot.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
okay,
well.
You know. Sometimes it works.
Sometimes, but, you know, that's a pretty small slice compared to the other side.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what people don't understand.
One of the worst overall things is that you're out there on the road, on stage, getting adulation from people who want your autograph so they can put it on eBay the next day and sell it for $200. And they're hounding you and blah, 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 and you're getting hit on by girls left, right, and center. You come home, and it's an empty house. And all you do is hear the white noise from the gig going through your head as you sit alone in the hotel room. That is one of the worst feelings there is. You have to learn to deal with that.
You're divorced once?
Twice.
Twice?
Yeah. I'm ashamed to say. But things are looking good for me right now. I have a new woman in my life. And
is there?
Yeah.
Well, that's always kind of an uptime then.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'm very happy about the current situation in my world. I didn't think it would happen to me in my 60th year.
She understand the life you've led?
She's trying to deal with it, yeah. I'm training her. What can I tell you? But it's tough.
It's tough, yeah, I know. I would love... Listen, I come to the part of the show where I always ask my guests, or I try to, and I know you got a cold, and I know you're not used to staying up real late, necessarily, but I'd love to let the audience ask you some questions, and I'm sure they would love to ask you some questions. It's just a matter of whether you're up for it and whether you're feeling all right.
Yeah, fine with it.
So then, really, you've been through a lot of times where you were up, back down again, rock bottom, starting all over again, a lot of starts over, huh?
Absolutely, but, you know, how would you know what the ultimate high in life can be if you haven't been to the bottom?
No, that's right.
And the blues music represents the bottom. Blues music is designed to heal and help people get over the worst crises in life. That's what's so beautiful about blues music. That's why it's cherished throughout the world still, even today in this world of hip-hop and whatever else is going on.
You mentioned politics. What are your politics like?
My political stance is to get people to dance. Still stand by it today.
Well, they danced their way through the Carter administration and through what's his name here recently, and they dance a lot in a lot of administration. I mean, I take you didn't really favor the Vietnam War.
I mean, coming from a half military family, I had sympathy for the combatants and for the soldiers. It wasn't their fault. The people that should have went on trial for that travesty should have been the generals and the captains and the colonels.
And maybe even a president.
And the map readers and the intelligence, or the lack of intelligence. The troops were blind faith. And the aftermath is just...
Yeah, well, you did what they told you, that you followed orders, you know. That's what you do in the military.
Of course.
Orders. All right, stay right there. We'll be right back, and we'll go to the phones with Eric Burton. I'm Art Bell from the High Desert. This is Coast to Coast AM. Don't touch that dial.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Thanks.
'Cause he was telling everyone in town of the love that he just found, and Marie's a name his latest friend. He talked and talked, and I heard him say that she had the longest, blackest hair, the prettiest green eyes anywhere, and Marie's the name of his latest friend. Though I smiled the tears inside were burning, I wished him luck, and then he said goodbye. He was gone, but still his words kept returning. What else was there for me to do but cry? Would you believe that yesterday this girl was in my arms and swore to me she'd be mine eternally, and Marie's the name of his latest flame. Though I smiled, the tears inside were a burning. I wished him luck, and then he said goodbye.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
Now, we were talking about Presley a while ago, and this record is sort of different from the rest of the genre from Presley. It's never left me. It's always haunted me. I don't know why. There's just something about it that haunts me. My guest is Eric Burden, and he'll be right back. We're about to go to the phones.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
Right, well, once again, back to Eric Burden. Eric, the House of the Rising Sun, I did want to ask you quickly about that. Did you ever get down to the real House of the Rising Sun in New Orleans?
Yeah, I eventually located what I believe to be the original House of the Rising Sun. It's owned by a very well-known attorney in New Orleans, and it's located on St. Louis Street. And has been carefully restored to its pristine original state. And I was lucky enough to be invited there to dinner one night. And to my surprise, the gathering of people there were basically comprised of about 40 Catholic nuns. Huh. Two high-ranking police officers and a couple of high court judges.
Oh, my.
And they requested that I sang the song in the main parlor, which was quite an experience.
Yeah, I bet it was. What was behind writing that?
Well, I didn't write it. It's traditional from way back. I believe it was an English folk song that came across the Atlantic with with immigrants, and that's my belief. There are other theories, but it certainly, it's in a minor key, and it certainly is not a blues progression. I would imagine that it's a derivative of a hymn, I believe.
What's it like when you release a song like that, and then you watch it, and it begins to grow, and it's like a snowball going downhill, gathering snow around it, just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and pretty soon someone walks in and says, "Guess what? Number one. Look, Billboard, number one." Must be a strange feeling.
Yeah, I can remember the night that it went to number one is crystal clear, like it was yesterday. It was just very, very special buzz in the room, and all of these young kids' faces were just lit up as we took the stage, and great. It was a great feeling, and I still get a kick out of singing that song. I mean, I improvise within the structure of the chords, and it's still an attractive song to sing today.
All right, to the phones. Here we go. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Eric Burden. Where are you, please?
This is Ann in Springfield, Missouri, KWTO. Keep watching the Ozark.
Hey there, Ann.
Hi, Art. Thank you. This is a great ride tonight.
Thank you.
Eric, babe, you rock my soul.
Oh, thank you, darling.
Before tonight's program, I indulged myself with your DVD, Eric Burden and the New Animals, Live at the Coach House.
Oh, yeah.
Killer concert. Nice. Loved it. Eric, could you tell us the story about an encounter with Janis Joplin during a warm San Francisco night?
Yeah, I was told that I wanted to go see the Doors were playing, and I can't remember who else, but I wanted to go to the Fillmore, and it was actually, impossible unless you had some sort of an inn. And I got word from one of the Hell's Angels that Janis would meet me at the stage door entrance at 1 o'clock on the dot, and there she was. And as I stepped across the threshold, she shook hands with me, and I opened my hand, and there was two purple pills in the palm of my hand, which I promptly ate. And it took us about 3 hours to get from downstairs, upstairs, through the dance floor, around the other end, down the stairs at the other end, and then the dressing rooms. It must have taken about 3 hours.
Little purple haze there. Well, yes, thank you. Your music keeps us young.
Thank you.
Take care. There've been rumors for years and years and years about a big stash of LSD that Timothy buried somewhere. You hear anything about that?
No.
All right. East of the Rockies.
I think he took it all with him.
That could be. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Eric Burden. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Bell. I'm Mr. Burden.
Hi.
My name is Steve. I'm a senior at the University of Iowa.
Oh, okay.
And I'm a research assistant to a class taught on Elvis Presley called Elvis's Anthology.
Really?
Yeah. We listen to a lot of old music and a lot of the music that influenced Elvis and other artists. And I guess what I'm curious about, I've read your book, Mr. Burden, the new one.
Yeah.
And it's really good. There's a little plug for you. I'm wondering if there are any of your influences that seem to be, I don't want to say forgotten, but maybe not as well known to people who are young, that you would like us to know about.
Well, I've said earlier on in the program when I was talking about Hendrix that we had a mutual friend out of Cleveland called Roland Kirk. He changed his name later to Rassan Roland Kirk. And to me, he was the most accomplished of all jazz musicians. But he was beyond the jazz musician because he sang gospel, played blues, And he could play three horns at once, and he had breathing techniques which were yogic, which meant he could play non-stop, and it's actually captured on one of his records, which have all been reissued, by the way, on Atlantic on CD, so you can get them all. And there's one session where he blows a tenor solo for the length of one side of an LP.
Wow.
Whoa.
Wow, that's incredible. You witnessed that yourself? You've seen that?
Oh, yeah, many times. Unfortunately, he pushed himself too hard, and he had a stroke in his 40s, and that was his demise after that. I mean, this guy really just wanted to get out of his body and into a different sphere. I mean, and his knowledge of old New Orleans marches and dirges and all the way up to, you know, playing pop music. He was just a walking sound tree, and I can't impress enough and to young Americans who haven't been exposed to this guy to listen to his music. This is absolutely wonderful.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you. I'll definitely check him out. I'm writing a thesis right now, and some of the academic powers that be don't think that this music is has enough merit to carry along academic research, but...
it's only been around 100 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Can I put that as a blurb on the front of it?
Well, just put in there that soon their generation will die and things will change.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
All right, you're welcome. Take care. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Eric Burden. Hi there.
Hello, is that me?
That's you, sir.
Oh, hey, how you doing, Eric?
I'm good. And you?
It's Randy from Reno Valley, just down the road here.
Yeah.
Couple things. I know a while back you bought a new Harley. I wondered if you're getting any chance to ride it.
Yeah, I rode it today, actually.
Did you?
Yeah.
Cool.
Went through the Joshua Tree National Monument. It was wonderful.
And one other thing, while I was sitting here waiting to get on, I flashed back to the Queen Mary. You looked across the bar and said, "Gene Vincent." And I said, "Huh? Gene Vincent, what do you think of him?" You caught me off guard. I didn't have much to say. But I just wondered if he was an influence or if he had some sort of, you know, pertinent meaning in your career.
Yeah, I've written quite a lot about Gene in my book, and
well, I've got the book, but I got to wait till the wife finishes reading.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, you'll find some titillating stuff about Gene in there.
Oh, okay. Nothing you want to tell us now, though, huh?
Great character. Well, you know, Gene was ultimate white trash, you know.
Really?
And I remember there was a session he was signed to Reprise, which was owned by Frank Sinatra. And Frank walked in the middle of one of Gene's sessions and promptly just ordered them out out of his studio. "I don't want this low-life rock and roll music in my studio." And he threw them out.
I understand he could party pretty good, though, huh?
Well, I would have taken that as a compliment.
Yeah.
All right, he mentioned Harley. You spent a lot of time with Steve McQueen.
Yeah, well, not a lot of time, but we were neighbors in Palm Springs for about 2 years and rode quite a lot with both dirt bikes and dune buggies. He had an awesome dune buggy with a 911 Porsche engine in it.
Wow.
Just a beast.
Wow.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun together.
I bet that thing would just about go straight up.
Yeah.
All right, first time caller line, you're on the air with Eric Burden. Hello.
Hi, Eric. This is Brian from San Diego. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
I had a couple of comments about Jimi Hendrix and a question about Jimi really quickly.
Yeah.
The comments are, I've been researching Jimi's life and music and everything for pushing 25 years, and I thoroughly believe that Jimi was murdered. It's next to impossible for someone to drown themselves in red wine. And I just, you know, there's such a focus on a lot of the drugs and so forth around Jimmy's life. And every opportunity I get, I try to, if you will, resurrect some of Jimmy's reputation. It doesn't bring him back, But he was such an incredible person living out his potential that this narrow focus, it seems to be pervasive. The other thing that I found out, and while I understand that Jimmy experimented with heroin, he was not a junkie and was actually terrified of needles.
I believe that's true.
Yes, sir.
But, you know, there was so much light around the guy, but he attracted so much darkness in those last days in London. And the first night he turned up the jam with me at Ronnie Scott's club, he definitely could smell it. He was out of control. But the next night, as I say, he came back and he was totally straight.
He was totally straight.
So that, to me, that proves he was dabbling and chipping, but I don't think he was
like a major. My last that thing here really quickly is that I've definitely experienced Jimmy's spirit before, and I don't do drugs at all. Over the last 30 years, I've had some more vivid and real than this world with Jimmy. And my question to you is, do you ever have you experienced Jimmy's spirit being with you or coming to you and being connected with you?
I've lived with it on a day-to-day basis the day he died.
What?
Well, not since the day he died, but
it was
the first day I ever saw him play.
Wow.
He's just there all the time.
Amazing. Well, I'd ask him tonight if he would help me get online to speak with you. So I want to say, sing on, brother, play on, drummer.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Eric Burden. Good morning.
It is such a pleasure to speak with both of you. What a show, Mr. Bell.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. You guys, I have a question for Mr. Burden. You were real an inspiration to, I can just feel all, I guess my generation, our generation, whatever you want to say, is just, I don't know, I can feel it tonight. It's just it's such a special guest, you know, Art, you have there. And
I know.
Golly. Well, anyway, I had a question for Mr. Burden there.
Go ahead.
It seems that it's so sad that it seems, the old saying, lonely at the top, you know, it seems, isn't it kind of scary in retrospect? Isn't it kind of, doesn't it make you wonder why they seek the top or why... because of such an influence that was created. You know.
Well, I've been able to deal with that because I never really searched for the top. I didn't come to America to have hit records and follow in the track of the Beatles and the Stones. I was going to come to America in the Merchant Navy. I came here to find the roots of what created this music, this blues music that enchanted the world, that changed the world. What caused it? What made it? You know, that's what I came here for, to live and research that. And maybe I got too close to it, and that's how, you know, I've had so many problems with the straight world business recording end of this recording business. I just don't see eye to eye with most people, you know.
Early on, after the early success and the band broke up, there were a few bucks missing, weren't there?
Well, I've been told about $6 million.
$6 million?
That's what I was told by an attorney who researched it. And I also have to say that that missing monies went into kickstarting Jimmy's career. I knew that we were using the same bank, the same accountants, the same management.
So it was development money for Jimmy, sort of, huh?
So, yeah, the Animals money, I believe, was used to seed Jimi Hendrix's career. And I have to point out here that two of the world's greatest artists projected as, you know, being having everything in the world that they ever wanted, Elvis Presley, when he died, had $35,000 in his bank account. Jimi Hendrix, when he died, had £7.95
My God.
Bank account.
Oh, my God.
It's incredible. It's murder. It's highway robbery and murder all over the place. There's bodies left, right, and center if you research it. It's incredible.
And how does that happen? I mean, how does it happen?
It happens because the nature of the business is that while you're out on the road performing, your money is going to a different location. You know, an artist can't be expected to pick up 20 grand at the end of a night after a festival and walk the streets of Detroit with 20 grand stuffed in your pants, you know. It has to go to
a business,
an agency, yeah, somewhere else, and you're separated from your money.
I understand. All right, hold on.
And then comes in what you call creative accounting.
Creative accounting. $6 million in creative accounting. All right. Eric Burden is my guest. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM in the nighttime.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
Into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown, like a dog without a bone, an actor all alone, riders on the storm. There's a killer on the road, his brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long holiday, let your children play. If you give this man a ride, sweet family will die. Killer on the road, yeah.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 21st, 2002.
Rock music is kind of very light at times.
Girl, you gotta love your man.
Sometimes it's very dark.
Now we take you back to the night of February 21st, 2002 on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Guest is Eric Burden. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. How did that feel, get inducted?
It was a bit weird because I was on tour in Germany at the time, and my keyboard player came across me and said, "Guess what? You've been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame." And I thought, "Oh, that's cool." But I couldn't be there because I was on tour. So the result of that was that the people at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame committee, they thought that I deliberately snubbed them, which
you
wasn't true at all. It's just that I had a job to do and I couldn't duck out of it.
did
talking about Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And by the way, you wrote another book entitled I Used to Be an Animal, But Now I'm All Right Now.
Yeah.
I Used to Be an Animal, But I'm All Right Now. Now, that did you come up with that title?
Yeah.
You did?
That's selling on the World Wide Web for like $300 a copy now, isn't it?
Why that title?
It was actually, I came out of a gig and it was written in graffiti on the wall. And in huge white letters. And I was photographed against it. And I thought, that'd be a great title for a book.
Might as well roll with it, huh?
Yeah.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Eric Burden. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Where
are you?
Oh, I'm in Providence, Rhode Island.
Yeah, okay.
But about 20 years ago, I was in L.A., and I was in a situation, and I got stuck, and I was hitchhiking, and Eric stopped and was very nice and gracious and helped me out and gave me a ride, and it's always been a... You know, it's a very unassuming. So I wanted to thank him for that.
You gave this guy a ride?
Yeah.
Eric?
I don't know. Where were you? Where was it at the time? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was in L.A. going down. I don't exactly remember where, well, the exact geography of it, but it was going down towards USC area, I guess, or...
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know, but I remember it was you and you were like really cool about, you know, you mentioned that you were in a band and I thought it was just a little band and you said, you know, the animals, oh my gosh. And,
Can you remember what car it was driving?
That's the thing. It was like a really, it wasn't like a rock star car or anything like that.
My El Camino pickup truck.
So you ran around for a while in a pickup truck, huh?
Yeah, I did the California thing to the max when I first came out here. You know, El Camino, rifle on the rack in the back, collie dog, and a Yamaha dirt bike in the bed, you know.
Well, sounds like you helped somebody out.
A lot of fun.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Eric Burden. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, sir.
A couple questions. One, you're out in the desert area around Joshua?
That's
Joshua
right.
Tree.
Remember what happened there with Croce? Jim Croce?
No, but lay it on me.
When he died, they flew his body in a casket to LAX.
No, that wasn't Jim Croce.
Pardon me?
That wasn't Jim Croce.
Yeah?
No.
And with Jim Croce, they flew into LAX, except one thing, they hijacked the coffin.
No, it was Phil Kaufman.
Joshua.
Well, all right.
It was Phil Kaufman, a friend of mine, who hijacked the coffin from LAX.
Oh, really?
And it was, what's his name, out of the Flying Burrito Brothers.
He hijacked the coffin?
Well, it was, I can't remember, what's the name, the guy out of the Flying Burrito Brothers, brain's gone, but he had a death wish, and in his will he wanted to have his body burnt up here in the Joshua Tree Monument.
Oh.
And his road manager Phil Kaufman went into the LAX morgue and they hijacked the body and brought it out here and set it on fire, on a funeral pyre.
Oh my God.
And in fact, on my new album, which will be out in the next few weeks, I have a song that is about that incident. It's called Highway 62.
Wow. I hadn't heard any of that. Holy smokes. First time caller line. You're on the air with Eric Burden. Hi.
Hi there.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling from Medina, Ohio. Listen to TAM out of Cleveland.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for the great show, and thanks, Eric, for the great music.
Thank you. Thanks for listening.
My question would be, after all the years that you've put in, is there a point you reach where it's strictly a job and financial, or does the music...
No, I mean, if it's a job, then it's the greatest job in the world, because I don't want any other job where you can walk into the office and scream at the top of your voice that you think the boss is out of his brain and he's doing everything wrong and this is the way it should be done, and sing your way through the day and get paid for it, you know. And that's what rock and roll allows you to do. So I feel that my job is a great job. I have a great job. I enjoy my job.
So even at the age of 60, as you say, that the music is still the drive that puts you on the stage and in the studio.
Oh, sure. I mean, like any other job, there are mornings when you go, oh, no.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. I mean,
I have to get out of bed and travel to Florida today.
Yeah.
But, yes, of course. And now with the new security systems that you got to go through to get on flights, it's made it even worse. You know? But... You know, that's my job, and that's what I chose to do, so I'll be there.
What do you, and you don't have to answer this, you don't want to, what do you think of America's position today? I mean, here we are, just struck with horrible terrorism. First time that most Americans living today have ever experienced anything like that on their own soil.
Well, I just have to say, great lack of intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
We knew, they knew this was coming.
They just didn't know where or when?
No, they didn't know on what scale, but I had a feeling they knew it was coming. I mean, come on, the towers had already been attacked once.
That's right. They knew it was a target.
You know, and without, you know, dissing the horror of losing that many people is a tragic thing to have happened. But, you know, and I spend a lot of time in Europe, and you know, there are ongoing terrorist attacks all the time over there.
That's right.
But we deal with them, you know. We don't go declaring war on the world, you know. This is a very precarious situation now we're in at the moment.
Precarious all over the world. Middle East is
absolutely
a disaster right now.
Absolutely. And,
all right.
All we can do is pray. We're doing the right thing.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Eric Burton. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, you got me here, Petaluma.
I do.
All right, Mike here. Hey, Eric. Been a long time. I helped you get on the stage there in Doheny. Remember you came in just about didn't make it there? I liked the band.
Doheny?
It was about a year ago.
Oh, yeah.
Coming in from the desert.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I like the band. I was wondering, are you promoting your new album now or a book?
Not yet. I can't promote any of the new album until it's all of the legal paperwork, publishing is all complete, because there's so many bootleggers out there that I have to be covered lawfully before I perform any of the new
right
ones. Yeah, that's a very good point. The world is changing, Eric, with the internet,
yeah,
and with the bootleggers, and with,
yeah,
you know, the minute anybody's got their hands on anything, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's unstoppable.
Yeah.
What do you think will be happen with this ultimately?
Well, it's killed the music business from my point of view. It's very damaging. I haven't been in the recording studio for many years because, A, I don't understand the new technology. I couldn't see a place for my voice in it until recently, when I met a producer who once was a drummer for me, Tony Brownagle, and showed me that he and his musicians and the system that he has in L.A. can record digitally, but can mix it and make it sound like it was recorded analog. And I'm very happy with the way my new record sounds. But I produced it myself, financed it myself, and I know the minute that it's released, it's going to be downloaded and bootlegged, but...
Yep.
At least if I have the publishing all tied up. At least I'll have some recourse to go after people.
The difference in music in the 60s and now, with all the digital technology, it's a big, it's not a little difference, it's a gigantic difference. I mean, there was, everything then was tubes, there was a certain built-in kind of nice distortion to it all. It's hard to describe, but there's...
Well, my theory behind that is that back when Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, and all those guys were recording at Sun, right? Most of the bands were three or four piece.
That's right.
And that meant one thing. It meant that every individual had his own miking system, which went into the four or eight track board. So each instrument had his own personal power, power line.
Yeah.
To the pressing of the record, and the grooves were much bigger and wider. So when you had just simply four or eight tracks dumped onto a 45 record and then pushed out over a Bell EMI jukebox, which was designed for that particular sound, it hit you right between the eyes.
That's right.
It wasn't stereo, it wasn't diffused, it was mono, and it just bang, it was just rock, just out there, and music doesn't sound that way these days, and people don't listen like they used to. They don't listen like they used to. They don't look at movies like they used to. MTV has ruined movies, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
I mean, the way people cut movies now, they cut movies like MTV videos.
Yeah, that's true.
There's only a few people like Robert Altman and directors like him that are still making movies in the old-fashioned way, where the images are warm and engaging and full of action on the screen. I mean, the digital effects have just taken over from writing and writers and stories. It's not a very good situation, and I think all of Hollywood know this. They're shaking in their boots at the moment.
Well, something's got to change, I think. Maybe it's just my age, but I can listen to music starting in the 50s and 60s and 70s a little bit, and I get into the 80s, and then there's not so much that I like. In the 90s, there's hardly anything, and I just, maybe I'm like my dad who used to run in, when I'd be playing songs like yours, and turn that trash on! And I'm getting that way because my age, I don't know, but it just has changed, and I wonder if it's ever going to swing back.
All I know is I buy CDs. It takes me a half an hour to break into the jewel box with a knife or with a pair of scissors.
Yeah.
I get it out, and you put one thumbprint on it, and it's click, jump, scratch.
Yep.
And it's over. And then you want to travel with it, so you take it out of the jewel box and you put it into a carrying case so you have it in your car. And then you've lost track of where the jewel box is, so it ends up just lying on a stack of other CDs that you've bought, gathering dust. And as soon as they've got dust on them, they don't play anymore.
And scratches.
Yeah.
I know. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Eric Burden. Good morning.
Hello, Art. How you doing?
Doing all right, sir. Where are you?
I'm in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
My name's Jay. Eric, I was wanting to ask you, I know you said earlier about blues music, how you was really influenced in that.
Yeah.
Are you influenced in any kind of country music? Like,
yeah,
Hank Williams?
I love country. I love any kind of music. Well, the music that I'm listening to more than anything right now is what is termed world beat.
Mm.
I love Gaelic music because it was the first music I ever listened to.
Scottish.
Yeah.
Really?
Scottish, Irish, pipes.
Yeah.
And the mixture now, some of these bands are mixing Celtic music with African beats, and that's what excites me, because that tells me that musicians around the world are uniting. There is an undercurrent of people coming together.
Well, see, I'm a musician myself, and I listen to a lot of Pink Floyd. I mean, I'm like 21 years old, but I still like it. I mean, it's really good to listen to. And I listen to all like Hank Williams stuff too. And, you know, I just blend everything that I listen to as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just wondered if you, you know, ever listen to anything like that.
Oh yeah, I love country music. I love folk music. Anything that's got soul.
There you are.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And I think we might have time, maybe, for... well, you know what? Let's take a second and plug at least your new book. When your new book is out now...
it's out now. It can order it on...
Amazon.
Amazon.com or directly from Thunder's Mouth Press in New York. And also you can get information from my website, which is... EricBurden.com.
Yeah, we've got all that, as a matter of fact, linked on my website right now,
yeah.
So that's an easy step for everybody.
How
do you feel about, after writing a book like that, and then it's suddenly out there, and how do you feel about it?
I feel pretty good about it. Some of the Q&As that I've done at signings, particularly when people have read the book, and they want to get deeper into some of the things that I've written, and it's a lot of fun to stand up there and answer people's questions and play around with theories. You know, they give me their theories, and I give them my input, and I enjoy it a lot. It's really good. I want to continue writing. I think I got several books in me. So
you're going to keep going?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, listen, God, what a pleasure it has been to have you here tonight. Unusual honor, and I hope all goes very well with your new lady and all with the new book and new music coming out. It's like starting all over again.
Again, again, again. I appreciate it. I've really enjoyed listening to the program, even though I've been a part of it. I've really enjoyed it.
All right, my friend. Good night.
Good night. God bless.
That's Eric Burden. Good night, Eric. That's it for tonight, folks. From the high desert.
In this dirty old part of the city.
I'm Art Bell.
When the sun refused to shine, people tell me there ain't no use in trying.
Ta-ta.
My little girl, you're so young and fresh, and one thing I know is true, gonna die before